waterproof tinting that we needed from the dealership, we left my new truck in Marty's care. Gabriel drove us home in his car. I used my night vision to read the owner's manual and brochures for my new truck.
Is it wrong that I'm actually considering pulling over so we can have sex without worrying about being heard?
He asked as we turned on County Line Road.
Not as wrong as the fact that I'm considering it, I said.
I looked out the window for a suitable makeout spot and found none. All I could see out the window was the county's water tower silhouetted against the full moon.
Stop the car, I yelled. Jane, I was only kidding. I know that having sex in a car in the middle of nowhere violates your how-to-avoid-being-killed-like-a-dumbass second-string character in a horror movie rules.
Stop the car! I hopped out before Gabriel was able to pull to a complete stop. The distance from the water tower seemed right, and the moon seemed to be in the right position, but I was viewing it from the wrong angle. In his jumbled thoughts, Ray McElroy had seen the lettering on the tower, Half Moon Hollow. All I could see was, ha.
Jane, what's wrong?
I think I know where to find him, I said, thankful that I'd worn my sensible sneakers while car shopping. Come on.
Jane,
he called as I took off running in a wide arc around the tower.
Don't you think we should call Ophelia and her team before we go chasing after Ray? He yelled as we ducked through the trees.
The same team that was so afraid of a little silver that they couldn't catch up with him the other night? The same team that Jamie can track with no problem and catch repeatedly? I called back.
Good point, he said. So, if and when we catch up to Mr. McElroy, what are we going to do?
No clue.
Excellent. We're throwing ourselves into imminent danger without a plan. The usual.
Hey, I have enough sarcasm of my own. I don't need yours.
Jane, stop.
I'm tired of waiting. I'm tired of cars being set on fire. I'm tired of hired guns lurking outside my house. I can't handle it anymore. You keep acting like you're trying to protect me, like I'm the one in trouble again. But you're the one he's after. You're the one in trouble. You're the one in danger. And I refuse to accept that. I saw the trailer where McElroy is staying. I saw it in his head, and I'm going to find it. I am going to find him and take his damn message, and then I'm going to shove it down his throat. Now you're either with me or you can go home.
Okay, then.
He grimaced.
Now that you've explained it to me in a rational manner, let's go.
What? He kissed me softly.
I'm with you, Jane. Always with you.
When we got closer, I saw that the trailer wasn't a trailer at all. It was an old school bus that had been spray-painted in camouflage. The walls were covered in gouges and rust stains. There were no lights, not even a flickering candle or campfire. A deer skull was mounted on the front fender, and cardboard covered two of the windows, which seemed to have been kicked in. There was actual Spanish moss hanging from the trees and brushing against the pressed metal roof. I didn't even know that we could get Spanish moss this far north. Maybe Ray had bought it at a craft store and hung it for ambiance.
Holy Mary, Mother of Cheese Whiz, I gaped.
This was the thing we didn't want people from outside Kentucky to know about. There are hard-working, middle-class, well-educated people living all over our fair state. People who have all their teeth, aren't married to their cousins, and have never even seen an episode of Lizard Lick Towing. But somehow, every time there's a natural disaster, news crews manage to track down one of these outdoorsy yahoos to interview about how the Twister came a-screaming down the holler and destroyed the snake farm his family had been running for generations. Frankly, I was surprised the camera crews hadn't found this place already. I tilted my head as we studied the exterior.
You know those moments in horror movies where the two stupid teenagers are about to stumble blindly into the serial killer's lair and you're screaming at the screen, "No, don't go in there! That collection of creepy doll heads is not just for decoration!" Because you honestly cannot believe two people could be that stupid?
Trust me, this is one of those moments.
I'll choose this moment to remind you that this was your idea. We can still call Ophelia.
There's no reason to now. I don't sense any thoughts, I said. No thoughts, no heartbeat. I mean, his scent is strong here, but he's not here.
His truck is here. I can see the glimmer of the grate under that brush over there, he said. And, if I'm not wrong, this patch of woods is just a mile or so from River Oaks. It explains how he's been able to hover so closely.
Do you think it's weird that there are no booby traps? I mean, this guy shot you with an arrow full of anticoagulants. You'd at least expect a tiger pit filled with big wooden stakes or something.
It is a little odd. This is where those hired goons would have come in handy. We could send them in as booby trap finders.
We could go home and bring back Jamie.
Come on, I said softly as we passed old lawn chairs and empty beer cans scattered across the ground. The little stop sign on the side was still intact, and I used it to pull the bus door open. When that didn't make the bus explode, I took it as a good sign. Before I hopped up onto the first step, I turned and asked, "We don't need tetanus shots, right?" He shook his head. "Good." How does someone actually live in a school bus? I wondered as we climbed aboard. With our remarkable night vision, we didn't need flashlights to look around, which was good because we didn't have one. I mean, there's no water. There's no bathroom. He must have a generator or something, because how else would he... Oh, dear. Wallpapering the interior of the bus were pictures of us. Long-range shots of Gabriel and me sitting on the porch swing, of our friends helping us move Gabriel's stuff into the house, shots taken through the front window of my shop, specs for my car's model, line drawings of my house, news clippings from the Half Moon Herald announcing Bud's death and our engagement. "This is scarily thorough," I muttered. I looked at the meticulously arranged corkboard, which included long-range pictures of me through the shop window. A copy of my weekly schedule was pinned to the cork. "I think it's fairly safe to assume that this is our guy. If he's pissed at you, why is all of his research on me?"
"He wants to strike where it hurts me most, by hurting you."
I cooed. "Aw, that's sweet in a sick, psychotic way. Still, I'm not the one who dropped a tree on top of his brother. I feel like I'm getting hosed here."
"Thank you for your concern."
Ray had installed makeshift counters where the bus seats used to be. They were crowded with half-empty cans of Beanie Weenies and Vienna sausages. Flies were buzzing thickly over the congealed contents. Empty bottles of cheap whiskey were scattered across the floor. An overly sweet, decaying scent hung in the air, with an undercurrent of vomit. Frankly, the place reminded me of my dorm's community bathroom on a Saturday morning. I know this is kind of a stupid question, but what's that smell? I looked up and saw that Gabriel's attention was drawn to a bunk bed bolted into the back of the bus. There was a dark shape huddled in the center of the mattress, covered by an old army blanket.
"Is that what I think it is?"
"Judging by the smell, I'd say it's a distinct possibility that's Ray McElroy himself,"
he said, pushing me behind him as we crept closer.
"He's human. He's definitely dead. The body's been here a few days and reeks of booze. He may have drunk himself to death after his failed attempt on you."
I groaned. "I am not calling this in to Ophelia, got it? I am sick of her snotty little jokes at my expense."
"Yes, because clearly protecting your feelings should be our chief concern when finding a dead body."
"Shut it," I sighed as we stepped closer.
"Would you recognize Ray if you saw him?"
I nodded. "Probably. You don't forget a guy with a curly mullet." Gabriel peeled back the blanket just an inch. I saw a head of dark, curly hair peeking up from beneath the blanket. I stepped forward to get a better look, and we heard an ominous clicking noise. I looked down and saw that some sort of panel had been cut into the floor a few feet from the bed, and I just stepped on it. I looked more closely at the flooring behind us and saw several little panels cut into the floor. We were lucky that we'd made it this far without stepping on one. From somewhere under the counter, I heard a tiny buzzing noise. Gabriel grabbed my hand.
"I think we need to back away from the bunk bed and get off this bus."
"I would, but I'm sort of paralyzed with fear right now," I said. The buzzing became the blaring of an alarm clock. In a flash, Gabriel was at the nearest emergency exit window and yanking it down. He practically threw me out of the opening. Just as my feet cleared the metal lip of the window, there was a deafening roar, and I felt Gabriel's weight crashing against me as we were blown away from the blooming burst of flame. The heat prickled across my back as he turned, throwing his arms around me and cushioning my fall. I landed with a wet thump, Gabriel on top of me, and we slid across the soupy mud of Ray's yard as bits of school bus rained down on us. Oh, and Gabriel's shirt was on fire. Gabriel wasn't all that concerned about this, as he seemed to be stunned into a coma. Coughing, I began beating on his back to put out the flames.
"Why are you hitting me?"
he asked groggily as I shoved him off of me and rolled his back against the ground. "Stop, drop, and roll!"
I yelled as I rocked him back and forth in the mud. What? You're on fire! Roll around!
I thought I smelled something burning, he murmured,
settling his face back down into the mud. I looked back at the flaming wreckage of the bus. You hit your head pretty good, huh?
Yep. I should be okay in a few minutes.
I'll wait, I said, carefully moving his head onto my lap. I stroked his hair. So, is it just me, or did these pranks make Missy's and Janine's seem cheeky and winsome by comparison?
Humph,
he said, nestling his face against my thigh.
So, can we assume that the body in the bus was Ray?
It seems too much to hope for, that this whole thing was resolved by binge drinking and homemade explosives. I shrugged. But what are the chances that he had a roommate? Ophelia was surprisingly gracious about the whole "we went off without you" thing once we explained that I happened to recognize the water tower. I supposed it helped that Jamie had seen the explosion and come running, so he was standing behind me while I was explaining the predicament. She probably didn't want to look like a total shrew in front of him. Ray's remains were collected by the human authorities. There wasn't much to collect, as the explosives had been stashed under the bunk bed. To me, that didn't make much sense. Why would anyone sleep on top of a large bomb? But Ophelia suggested that maybe he wanted to take out anyone who got that close as he slept. He didn't care whether he survived. Sergeant Russell Lane of the Half Moon Hollow PD, who seemed to be the only police officer on duty whenever I got into trouble, promised that they would identify the remains by dental records as soon as possible. I had the feeling that Ray didn't have any dental records, which would make identification more difficult. Jane, do you think you'll be able to keep yourself out of trouble for the remaining 3 days before your wedding, or will I need to double your guards? Ophelia asked. I think I'll be fine, I said contritely. Ophelia smiled blandly. Well, I'll still keep them stationed outside the house, just in case. I'm sure there's more than one person interested in killing you in a splashy public fashion. I would take offense to that, but you're probably right. Gabriel's wounds healed quickly enough, although Jamie helped me load him into his car so we could drive home. Gabriel's concussion also led to his singing various Motown songs, which Jamie recorded on his phone for his own amusement. With precious little time left before the wedding, I logged as many hours in the shop as possible, preparing it and Andrea for the week Gabriel and I would be spending away at an undisclosed honeymoon location. I trusted Andrea and Dick to take care of the business, and I trusted Jamie not to run away with the circus, but I didn't trust myself not to check my voicemail every 5 minutes to make sure nothing had blown up or been sprayed with battery acid in my absence. Honestly, I was lucky to have the shop to distract me. I had very little to do wedding-wise, thanks to Iris. She'd emailed me an itinerary for the day before and the day of the wedding. I just had to show up at the right time and get dressed. If I wasn't marrying one of the most beautiful men on the planet, I'd have been tempted to give her a big, wet kiss. Andrea came toddling from the supply room, struggling to gracefully move a bulky, half-constructed cardboard display. What are you doing? I asked as she flipped white cardboard tabs into place and flipped the top of the display over to reveal a pair of intricately printed silver bells that read Eternal Bliss in a curlicued font.
Opening us up to a whole new literary market, she exclaimed before dashing back to the storeroom.
She came back with a case of books similarly stamped Eternally Yours. Andrea abused her vampire speed, unpacking and shelving the books with a flourish and stepping back.
Ta-da!
She shouted.
You've fallen completely over the edge into asylum territory, haven't you? She frowned. No, you jerk. Ta-da, as in, welcome to the wedding planning section of our shop. How can we separate you from your hard-earned money today? You would not believe how many people have become interested in vampire weddings over the last couple of weeks, whether it's because of the stories circulating in the human community about your wedding or because it just became legal, I don't know, but we've had several customers come in and request books and planners for vampire nuptials, and they were extremely disappointed that we didn't have any. So, I looked up a couple of distributors online and found these. A Novice's Guide to Planning a Charming Vampire Wedding, Elopement for the Eternal, Weddings and the Dysfunctional Undead, A Vampire's Guide to Establishing a New Family Without Killing the Old One. They're great, informative, thorough, and occasionally pretty damn funny.
And you didn't think to tell me about these books while I was planning my own wedding, because... She chuckled.
Because the line was just launched. And because seeing me drive myself crazy amuses you.
Jane, if you'd been able to read these books, would you have felt more prepared? Or would you have worked yourself into an information overload-fueled frenzy, convinced that you could arrange the whole wedding yourself and eventually killed one of your loved ones in a glue gun-related mishap?
She asked. Her lips quirked. Probably that second one, I admitted. She hiked her fists on her hips.
Okay, then. I think the words you're looking for are, thank you, oh newly promoted assistant manager, for finding yet another revenue stream for specialty books. Without you, my shelves would be empty, I would have few customers, and my coffee would burn holes in those customers' throats.
I think that was implied. She shook her head.
No, no, I'm going to need to hear it.
Thank you, oh... I stopped as I heard the little cowbell over the door jingle, indicating that a customer was walking in. Oh, thank God, because there was no way I was going to really say that. I turned to find a familiar blonde tentatively poking her head through the front door. Mrs. Lanier? I reached under the counter for the pepper spray we kept there. Andrea circled the coffee bar to stand at my right. Her face was neutral, but not friendly. Clearly, Andrea believed she was the only one allowed to abuse me. Mrs. Lanier was going to have to line up behind her. Rosie Lanier tried to smile, but her muscles couldn't seem to form the expression. She cleared her throat.
Jane?
Is there something I can do for you? I asked gently, although my hand was still firmly on the pepper spray. She cleared her throat again. I reached into the mini-fridge and pulled out a bottle of water for her. She stepped back, as if she wasn't prepared to accept any sort of kindness from me.
I can't pretend I'm happy to be here, Jane. I never thought...
She crossed to one of the little tables and plopped down in one of the comfy purple chairs. I took a stool near the coffee bar.
When I heard what happened to you, I thought, oh, poor Sherry. I never even considered that something like that could happen to my own child. I thought we were safe. We were a good family, good people, she said.
So was my family, with the possible exception of Grandma Ruthie. Mrs. Lanier ignored me as if she'd already planned her speech out in her head and any interruption would only put her off her place.
I was so angry with you when I found out what happened. I mean, it was bad enough that Jamie had been turned, but that it was by someone we knew? It felt like you should have known better, like you should have been more loyal. After all the time we'd spent with her family, I thought, after all those Labor Day picnics and camping weekends and New Year's Eve parties, how could she do this to us? I hated you. So much. The more I thought about it, the more you seemed to morph into this hideous monster in my head, this dangerous, vicious tramp who'd stolen my son's life away.
I don't know how to respond to that, I muttered. She chuckled, and for the first time in months, I saw her smile.
That changed one night when I was looking through some old albums, looking for pictures of Jamie. I found this.
She slid an old, battered 4x6 photo across the table. I groaned as Andrea swooped in, grabbed the photo, and guffawed. I glared at her.
Right, she said, slapping the photo into my hand. Sorry.
The picture showed Jenny, Jamie, and me during a camping weekend at Barkley Lake. Jamie must have been 6 or 7, his straw-colored hair sticking straight up from the back of his head like a peacock's tail. Somehow paired with the thumb-width gap between his top front teeth, the freckles across his nose only made him more adorable. At 21, Jenny was still blonde, polished, and perfect, and clearly humoring the both of us as we forced her to help us sing some old Oak Ridge Boys song, just because Jamie liked to sing the Oompapa Mau Mau chorus. And there was awkward, buck-toothed me, with the unfortunate bangs and knobby knees. I smiled goofily into the camera with a sort of bemused confidence that this picture was going to come back and haunt me. Even then, I had a pretty profound grasp of future humiliation.
I saw this picture, and I remembered this trip with your family. I remembered, even then, how good you were with Jamie, how you kept him out of trouble all weekend by telling him stories about Huck Finn and Daniel Boone. I remember telling your mama what a good mother you were going to make someday, and how she just beamed at the thought. And I realized that girl would never do anything to put Jamie in danger. That girl who devoted most of her adult years to helping kids learn to love books couldn't change so drastically.
That girl would give her last breath to keep someone she saw as a child safe.
Her lip trembled and her eyes filled.
It was me. I brought this down on us. It's my fault. When you returned, I felt so sorry for your mama for such a thing to happen to her. But all the while, I was feeling smug and superior because it could never happen to me, not in my family. I'm being punished, don't you see? I was so proud, so arrogant, I gave the Lord no choice but to smack me down.
It doesn't really work that way, I said. I wasn't turned as part of a great karmic payment plan. It just happened. The same with Jamie. It just happened. Trying to find a villain here is like trying to pin the blame on someone when a meteor lands on them. I judiciously decided not to tell her about the driver who mowed her son down and how he may or may not have tried to do further damage to members of the household. That struck me as a need-to-know sort of thing. She bit her lip, her eyes filling, as she asked,
"Is he happy?"
I reached across the table to pat her hand, but she withdrew it. I tried not to let that hurt my feelings. "He misses you. He's confused, scared, but no more so than any kid who's growing up. He's a good kid, Miss Rosie. You did a wonderful job raising him. And he's the very best kind of vampire. He's just like he was as a human. He just has fangs. He doesn't hurt people. He doesn't abuse his powers. He's still your boy. And he would love to see you."
"I'm not sure if we can do that yet," she said. "I'm afraid of what I'll see when I look at him. It will break my heart if he still looks like my little boy, and it will break my heart if he doesn't. I don't know when I will be ready. I know your mama's all on board with the friends and family of the undead, but I'm not ready to march in any nighttime pride parades. It's going to take me some time."
"Please at least consider it." She smiled, tight-lipped but sincere.
"I will."
"So you're not angry with me anymore?"
"No. I'm not going to be sending you a batch of macaroons anytime soon, but I think we're going to be okay."
"Damn! I wish you hadn't reminded me how much I loved your macaroons. But thank you for forgiving me. You wouldn't mind passing word around about our newly established peace treaty so I don't get variations of murdering bitch painted on my windows, would you?" She cringed.
"I'm sorry about that. I'll admit the first time it was me. But I'll call the phone tree and cancel it for everybody else."
"That is a clear misuse of your PTA organizing skills."
"We work with what we have," she said, blushing sheepishly.
"I'll keep you in mind the next time I'm arranging a vampire carpool." Chapter 16. It's important to take time for yourself. Siring is a difficult, draining business. Set aside little treats for yourself. A hot bath, a good book, a battle to the death. A tired sire is an ineffective sire. Siring for the Stupid, a beginner's guide to raising newborn vampires. It was apparently the evening to resolve feelings with problematic maternal figures, because I came home from work to find that Gabriel and Jamie had helped Mr. Wainwright set up an exorcism ritual space smack in the middle of my parlor. There was a huge symbol drawn in white chalk on the hardwood, circled in sea salt. It sort of looked like a cross between a sperm and a beached sea cow. Unlit white candles were placed at each compass point. Jamie was chattering excitedly about following Mr. Wainwright's careful instructions from a book called Spirit Rituals and Rites.
"Mr. Wainwright found just the right ceremony. He's sure of it this time. And now, Gabe and I have to go out back and take a bath because we're not supposed to carry the ritual object's energy around with us. You're going to have to take one, too, before the ritual. Isn't that cool?"
he cried as Gabriel kissed me. I laughed at Jamie's puppy-doggish enthusiasm and wondered if I'd sired a closet D&D freak. I tousled his hair, and for once he didn't complain about the gesture, instead dragging me around the room to examine all of the different crystals and herbs involved in setting up my grandmother's spiritual eviction. In that moment, I decided against telling Jamie about his mother's visit to the shop. If she came to terms with his condition and was able to attempt a relationship with him, he wouldn't need to know that she'd needed a pep talk first. And if she decided against seeing him again, I didn't want to give him false hope. For now, he was mine, and he seemed to be thriving.
"Yes, bathing in the yard, using the hose,"
Gabriel deadpanned as I picked up spirit rituals and rites and shuffled to the page Mr. Wainwright had marked.
I cannot believe the luck, especially when you consider that there are hired mercenaries watching the house who will no doubt enjoy the spectacle.
Dude, Mr. Wainwright told you about what would happen if you entered the ritual space.
After I'd already entered it, so the warnings were a bit of a moot point,
Gabriel exclaimed as Jamie jostled him on the way out the back door to their chilly evening toilette. Mr. Wainwright and Jetty materialized at my elbow. I compared the page to the symbol marked on the floor. Mr. Wainwright, I think you have this wrong. This isn't an exorcism ritual. This is a summoning ritual. Mr. Wainwright grinned at me.
Quite right.
But we don't want Grandma Ruthie to stick around. We want her gone, possibly in another dimension. Are there dimensions without support hose? Because that would be sort of funny.
Jane, have you ever heard the expression, if you can't beat 'em, join 'em?
He asked. Not from you, I said.
I've looked into all of the pertinent books, and I cannot find a single ritual more powerful than the one that failed to, well, dislodge your grandmother. And you'll notice that while she has made several appearances here, she hasn't been able to move to different locations, although she could have caused serious trouble if she'd decided to vandalize the stock at the shop or cross the field to scare Zeb and Jolene's children. It seems as though her obsession with the family home has bound her spirit too tightly to this particular building, and as such, it will be impossible to force her to move on involuntarily.
Well, that is incredibly depressing news, which again makes me question the whole ritual thing. Jetty nudged me with her insubstantial hip.
If you flip the problem over and look at it from another angle, it makes more sense. If we can't force Ruthie out, what can we do to make her want to leave? Not only the house, but the earthly plane.
If the answer is to burn down the house, I have to say that's a little extreme. Jetty rolled her eyes.
No, honey. What does Ruthie hate more than anything?
Feminists, unruly children, long-haired dogs, certain unnamed ethnic groups, beach weddings, people who email thank you notes, and me. Jetty gave me a pitying but understanding glance.
Being married, Jane. Your grandmother loves marrying men and she loves burying them, but she's never been very good at anything in between. She loves the romance and the excitement of the big events, but the everyday stuff bores her to tears. Frankly, I was shocked that she spent enough time around your Grandpa John to have your mother.
Didn't need that mental image, but you make an excellent point, I said. Grandma's interest tended to wane after she threw the bridal bouquet. She'd send her husbands off to their hobbies while she occupied herself with Junior League or the garden club, but the moment one of them suffered a bizarre accident, she was the consummate grieving widow, a postmenopausal Juliet elegantly distraught over the loss of her soulmate.
We were thinking that inviting a few people here to discuss Ruthie's occupation at River Oaks might prompt her to pull up stakes, Jetty said.
I gasped. We're going to summon all of Grandma's dead husbands? Jetty's lips quirked.
No. Ruthie's various exes will be here at midnight. Gilbert and I have spent weeks talking them into coming here.
So that's where you've been, Jetty continued.
The summoning is for Ruthie. We want to force her to appear and keep her here long enough to talk to her.
Midnight is in about 20 minutes, I said, checking the clock on the mantel.
Which means you need to go outside for that bath,
Mr. Wainwright said, gently pushing me toward the door. Can't I just run upstairs and take a shower? I whined. Clothed in white pajamas, Gabriel and Jamie held up a ring of sheets around a metal washtub in the yard. The light of the full moon overhead lent a silvery, otherworldly glow to the unceremoniously simple bathing station. I stepped into the little tub and winced at the cold water lapping around my feet.
You have to be cleansed outside the house so that none of your creepy grandma's energy can affect you,
Jamie said, his eyes alight and averted as I stripped down.
Can you believe all this?
Yes. I've spent 2 years surrounded by all this at the shop,
I told him, dutifully washing my arms and legs with the hyssop soap Gabriel had left out for me. Mr. Wainwright was talking Loch Ness and poltergeist before the end of my interview. I've probably read every occult title available in print.
That's what you sell at the shop?
Jamie exclaimed, although he was respectful enough not to turn and look at me.
Yes. What did you think we sold at the shop?
Jamie shrugged.
Romance novels? Girly books?
Gabriel sighed.
It's been nice knowing you, Jamie.
Romance novels? I cried. Why would I open a vampire-specific store for romance novels? Didn't you ever read any of the titles when you were in the store?
I was a little busy trying to scope out you and Andrea without Dick noticing.
He scoffed. He bit his lip when he realized his admission and the fact that I was standing mostly naked on the other side of a very thin sheet.
Not that I would do that now, because you're sort of this big sister mother figure for me, and that would be weird.
Thanks, I grunted, turning the hose on and shrieking when the cold water hit my skin.
Can I come down to the shop sometime?
He asked.
If this is the kind of stuff you have there, I'd really like to look at some of the books.
Aw, I would love that, I chuckled. I would hug you right now, but I'm naked and my big vampire fiancé is standing right behind me.
I appreciate that,
Jamie said.
Thank you for thinking of me, Gabriel said with a snort.
He pulled a brand new set of white cotton pajamas out of a shopping bag by his feet and tossed them over the curtain. I eyed them curiously.
Mr. Wainwright said we should wear clothes that haven't been in the house yet. I know better than to try to pick out clothes for you, but I thought pajamas would be safe.
I beamed at him. You are so the guy for me. Suitably cleansed and dressed, the three of us entered the house just as the clock showed 10 till midnight. I picked up the book and began reading the passage Mr. Wainwright had marked.
I summon the spirit of my ancestor. Ruth Ann Early Lang Bodine Floss Whitaker, come forth from the mist. Pull back the veil and speak.
Silence. The only noise in the room was the ticking of the clock on the mantel.
Ruthie Early, I called. I am your blood. I command you to come forth and speak.
Nothing. Grandma Ruthie, if you don't get your see-through butt down here, I'm going to tear out the kitchen and put in a home gym. You know I don't eat, so that's not an empty threat. An angry swirl of red energy emanated from the center of the symbol, rising to eye level. Grandma Ruthie appeared, her silvery eyes flashing dark as she tried to hover over my head, intimidating me. I felt Gabriel and Jamie at my back, ready to shove me out of the way if Ruthie happened to have found her scissors. The symbol kept her inside the circle, unable to rise. She glowered at me and crossed her arms over her chest.
Who do you think you are, Jane Jameson, telling me what to do in my own house?
Grandma Ruthie, I'm giving you one last opportunity, I said. Leave my house now. Find some other place to spend your time. Better yet, move on to the next stage. I don't want any more ugliness between us. And I think we can agree that trying to exist in the same house will only lead to more ugliness.
I have no reason to leave my house, Jane, she sniffed. If anyone is going to leave, it's you.
Are you saying that if I gave you reason to leave, you would move on?
I can't think of any possible motivation you could come up with that could change my mind, she sneered. Oh, I don't know about that,
Jetty sing-songed as several translucent forms shifted through the walls of the parlor and hovered around the circle. We watched as they solidified into human shapes, and I began recognizing faces. Grandpa John I only knew from pictures my mom had around the house. His face was young, handsome. He'd been in the prime of life when the truck struck him down. I had a hard time imagining this man, who was currently winking at me and grinning like a fool, ever marrying my grandmother. On purpose. Then there was Grandpa Tom, dressed in natty picnic attire. He and Ruthie had been on their way to a Labor Day celebration when he'd sampled her famous strawberry rhubarb pie and discovered a serious allergy to rhubarb. His airway swelled shut before the ambulance could even arrive. Grandpa Jimmy looked skittish and nervous, which was exactly what you would expect from someone who died from a brown recluse bite on the inside of the throat. And poor Grandpa Fred, struck down on the 12th hole at the Half Moon Hollow Public Golf Course, was still wearing ugly plaid pants and a hat with a little puffball on top. I could not imagine spending the rest of eternity dressed like that. I was glad to have Aunt Jetty out of the house with Grandpa Fred there. They had a complicated history. Aunt Jetty and Grandpa Fred began dating, or what could be considered dating when one was a shade of the great beyond, shortly after her death. In her defense, there weren't many men in the Hollow who hadn't been married to Grandma Ruthie. It limited her dating pool. Through my employment at the shop, Aunt Jetty met Mr. Wainwright, who was still living at the time. They started spending time together. Mr. Wainwright died, and the next thing he knew, poor Grandpa Fred and his little puffball hat were all alone. The only ex unaccounted for was Grandma's former fiancé, Bob, who died as the result of a Viagra mix-up the previous year. I guess he considered his business with Ruthie concluded.
"What is the meaning of this?"
Grandma Ruthie shrieked, shrinking away from the ghostly circle forming around her.
"What kind of cruel, inhuman joke are you trying to pull, Jane?"
"I didn't have anything to do with this, Grandma Ruthie, but I think your former husbands have some things they'd like to say to you." And with that, a wall of chatter seemed to crash through the room like a tidal wave. Hurts, disappointments, past arguments, resentments that each man had carried to the afterlife from his time with Ruthie. You know those British Parliament sessions they show on C-SPAN where everyone's talking over one another and shouting and booing and you're thinking, middle school social studies would have been so much more interesting if we got to study this? It was a lot like that. Grandpa John told Ruthie that the only reason he'd been hit by that truck was that he was leaving at dawn to squeeze in extra hours at the sawmill to pay off the bills she'd run up all over town pretending to be some southern belle. And he was insulted that she'd moved on so quickly and married his best friend less than 2 years after he'd died. Grandpa Tom accused her of marrying him because she liked his house, but not him. Grandpa Jimmy wanted to know why Grandma Ruthie banned his family from his funeral and said she had no right to hold on to the Civil War memorabilia he'd planned to pass on to his grandsons. And Grandpa Fred said that death was a sweet relief, even if it meant getting struck by a billion volts just to get away from her nagging. The barrage of relationship dysfunction continued for half an hour before I could get any of my former grandfathers calmed down. Jetty had settled on the couch and was gleefully watching it all play out like a tennis match, so she was no help. Ruthie's ghostly form seemed to shrink in on itself with every volley lobbed by her exes. Finally, it took Jamie sticking his fingers in his mouth and whistling for the jabbering to slow down.
"Fine, fine, fine," Grandma Ruthie screeched. "Maybe I wasn't the best wife to any of you, but you were miserable excuses for husbands. Maybe if you tried just a little bit harder, life would have been a little easier for us. But it's all over now. We're all dead. I hope you all got your closure so you can just shut up and move on."
"But, Grandma Ruthie, they're not moving on," I said, smiling sweetly.
"They're not?"
she asked, her voice growing suspicious. "Shoot, no, but they're all going to move in with us."
"What?"
Gabriel and Jamie chorused. "Yep, that's part of the summoning rite," I said. "We're going to anchor the fellow's spirits to River Oaks, just like Ruthie has managed to do all on her own. I just have to repeat this handy chant 3 times, and it's a done deal. It's going to be a grand old time, Grandma. Me, you, and my 4 grandpas will be one big happy family. Just imagine, you'll have all day and all night for the rest of eternity to devote to one another, and you'll have time for long, long conversations about how your relationships went wrong. I can see it now, the whole clan gathered around the fire, the lingering smell of Bengay permeating the air, playing pinochle and singing campfire songs, nothing but family time and lots of togetherness." Somehow, Ruthie's translucent face went even paler.
"No, Jane, you can't do that. I won't allow it. This is my house, mine. You don't have the right."
I raised the book, turning the page, and read aloud. "Spirits of hearth and home, hear me now. Gather those spirits present and bind them to this place," I chanted as Grandma Ruthie begged me to stop. "By Hestia, by Hecate, I ask that you grant us an eternal home, an eternal family. As I will, so mote it be."
"Jane, stop it,"
Grandma Ruthie screeched.
"Please, I'll do anything."
"Spirits of hearth and home, hear me now. Gather those spirits present and bind them to this place," I chanted again. By Hestia, by Hecate, I ask that you grant us an eternal home, an eternal family. As I will, so mote it be.
Jane!
Ruthie wailed piteously as I started the third round. I could see her form fading, her outline becoming more and more shadowed.
Jane, no!
By the time I'd reached the third by Hestia by Hecate, Grandma Ruthie had shrunk down to a tiny, pearl-sized blip in the atmosphere over the symbol. It disappeared with a faint pop, and the atmosphere in the room warmed by a few degrees. Did it work? I asked Mr. Wainwright. She's really gone this time?
Well, the energy coming off the symbol has sizzled away to nothing, so I'm going to say yes. Your grandmother voluntarily severed her connection to the house in order to escape to the next plane, he said. You did very well, Jane.
Thank you. I beamed as Gabriel squeezed my shoulders. Jetty was bent over, laughing so hard that she couldn't congratulate me. I took that as a good sign.
So I guess things are going to be a little more crowded around here, huh?
Jamie said as the grandpas milled around the room, talking among themselves. Grandpa Fred was giving Aunt Jetty and Mr. Wainwright a wide berth, but I was glad that he'd been mature enough to put his feelings aside and help me out.
They're not going to hang out in my room, are they? Because I sort of have a non-nursing home vibe going up there.
What are you talking about? I asked.
The grandpas. They're all moving in, right?
Oh, the binding thing? I asked, laughing.
I was bluffing.
Gabriel burst out laughing. Jamie's jaw dropped.
But the whole incantation thing and the chanting.
I made it up. Pulled it out of thin air, I said, shrugging. I told you, I've spent 2 years in an occult shop. It was bound to rub off on me.
And you say I'm a lousy actress. I poked Gabriel in the chest.
I never said you are a lousy actress. I said you have no poker face. But I proudly admit that I am wrong. That was masterful, Gabriel said.
But what were you going to do if she called your bluff?
Jamie demanded. Figure something else out, I said. I would have kept bluffing until Ruthie admitted that the only thing that horrified her more than me owning the house is the idea of sharing it with the men she's jettisoned into the grave.
I think the word jettisoned hurts my feelings,
a kind voice behind me said. I turned to find Grandpa John smiling fondly at me.
You have turned out to be a real firecracker. You know that?
I nodded sheepishly. Over John's shoulder, I could see the other grandpas waving at me and phasing through the exterior walls, going back to their individual haunts. I waved back, unsure of what to say besides mouthing, "Thank you."
I'm sorry I never stopped by before, Jane, but I wasn't sure how you'd react,
Grandpa John said.
I stayed around to watch your mama grow up, you know. And when she had you and Jenny, I couldn't bear to leave. I've had so much fun watching all my girls live their lives. Now that you're aware of me, I might stop in every once in a while if that's all right with you.
Sure. Grandpa John eyed Gabriel and Jamie as they argued about the best way to clean up the chalk outline on the floor.
You've made this place quite the home, haven't you?
Despite all odds.
I think that's why your grandmother never really got this place. She saw it as something to show off, to lord over other people, even when it was falling apart at the seams. She never saw it as a place where a family lived. You get that.
I smiled and ducked my head, only to feel the cool pressure of his hand on my shoulder.
I'm very proud of the person you've become. I think we would have gotten along just fine if I'd lived. No matter what your grandmother might have told you, I always liked a girl with spunk.
Grandpa John winked at me and pinched my cheek as he faded out of sight. Thanks, Grandpa. Chapter 17. It is vital to foster loyalty in your child. You will need your child someday, whether it's a year or a century from now. A loyal child will heed the sire's call no matter where the child is. A resentful child will take time to make himself or herself comfortable while he or she enjoys your misfortune. Siring for the Stupid, A Beginner's Guide to Raising Newborn Vampires. Time is a funny thing. The weeks leading up to the wedding seemed to be moving it fast forward, what with blowing up a school bus, evicting a dead grandparent, and building relationships with dead grandpas. But somehow,
Walking down the makeshift aisle we'd constructed on the back lawn of River Oak seemed to take forever. For the rehearsal, Daddy was at my elbow, half leading, half dragging me. I'm sure that in his head he was already compensating for the support I would need, negotiating the grass and my dress. Gabriel was waiting for me, and I just couldn't seem to get to him fast enough. Iris was standing near the arbor that would be wrapped in flowers and ribbon while we were sleeping the next day. She was carefully reviewing the ceremony notes with Jolene's Uncle Creed, who performed all marriage rites in the pack as the eldest of the clan and a justice of the peace. Reverend Neil was a good man, but his liberalities only stretched so far, and I found the idea of being married by a notary public sort of depressing. It was a special honor for a werewolf to extend such a gesture of friendship to a vampire, and without Jolene's intervention, it wouldn't have happened. Jolene's parents were there, along with the aunties who could stomach my presence. I had to find some way to thank them for replicating my dress, and for a werewolf, that means feeding them. All of the non-vampires would be enjoying a big batch of Mama's homemade lasagna at her house while Gabriel was led to his bachelor party doom. I think I was supposed to go to my room and pretend to be a virgin for one more night. Mama couldn't have been more pleased with Iris's work, including the arrangement of a slightly more traditional wedding party than Jolene and Zeb had. Andrea was my maid of honor, and Zeb was my best man. Dick was the best man for Gabriel's side, with Jolene and Jenny in the supporting roles. I tried to get Jamie to serve as ring-bearer, but he refused to carry the little pillow. Instead, he was the groomsman in charge of leading Fitz to the bride's family row and keeping him from chasing squirrels during the ceremony. After sitting through countless prolonged weddings that left my butt numb and my nerves frayed, I wanted to keep the ceremony itself short and sweet, and Gabriel agreed. I walk up the aisle, we say the vows, we walk down the aisle together. No staring into each other's eyes while soloists warble that what the world needs now is love, sweet love. No special readings from Corinthians or Shakespeare, and no unity candle. Open flames and veils tend to make vampire brides very nervous. The good news was that this simplified the rehearsal considerably, and since everybody in the wedding party had been through the process before, they knew where to stand, where to face, and how to hold their flowers. And they knew the special step together, step together rhythm required to time their aisle walk appropriately to the processional. If I could just get Uncle Creed to call me Jane instead of Jean, we'd be in business. Iris considered us sufficiently rehearsed and gave us all our wedding day itineraries. Mine said, show up at sunset, get dressed, relax. I think I love you, I told her. She shrugged. I get that a lot. If you'll excuse me, I have to go pry your mama off of Uncle Creed before she talks him into an altar call or something. She scurried away, clipboard in hand, and Gabriel pressed a kiss to my mouth. This is your last night as a single woman. What do you plan on doing? Sleeping, reading, worrying about you and my child and how you will be emotionally scarred by the cut-rate strip club Dick drags you to.
For your information, we're not going to a strip club, Dick sniffed. We're going to a casino.
How are you going to get Jamie into a casino? He's underage. Dick shook his head.
You don't want to know.
You're right, I don't. Just don't let anything happen to him, okay? Dick, I think it goes without saying that if anything happens to Gabriel to prevent him from making it to the altar tomorrow night, I will hold you responsible. And afterward, grown men will weep when they see what I've done to you. Dick snorted and kissed my forehead.
And yet you feel the need to say it anyway.
It's a formality. Most of the guests had already departed for Mama's dinner. As the boys loaded themselves into Zeb's car, I bade Andrea and Jolene goodnight and kissed the twins. Jenny hugged me tight and promised to slip Mama a Xanax before I could rise the next night. I whistled for Fitz and went upstairs to take off my makeup and change into some sweats. The house was blissfully quiet, especially with Jetty and Mr. Wainwright off to complete some secret wedding-related task. I lay on my bed and closed my eyes, wondering if I was going to be able to sleep a wink that day. Downstairs, I heard a soft knock on the door. Remembering the still unidentified remains of Ray McElroy, I grabbed a baseball bat from Jamie's room and crept quietly down the stairs. Who is it?
Honey, it's Daddy. Open up.
I whipped the door open to find him grinning at me.
Grab your purse, honey.
But I'm wearing sweatpants. Where are we going?
It's a surprise, and you're dressed just fine, he said, his eyes twinkling as he led me to the car.
Your mama's letting me off the hook tonight so I can have some special time with my girl before she becomes an old married woman.
Watch it, I warned him as we pulled out of the driveway and into town.
I kept up a constant stream of chatter about my father's classes, his students, Mama's compulsive cleaning of the house as she worked through her anxieties over the wedding. Daddy pulled his car toward downtown, onto Main Street, and finally, into the parking lot of the coffee spot. I gasped. The coffee spot had been our special place since I was little. Daddy and I would leave early on Saturday mornings under the pretense of running errands, and then we'd camp in a corner booth for most of the day, talking and eating cheese fries. Mama never could figure out how running to the hardware store and the grocery store always ended with Daddy getting Velveeta on his shirt. Of course, those cheese fry runs got fewer and farther between when I went away to school, and even farther when Mama saw Daddy's cholesterol results. And they stopped altogether when I went on the liquid diet. I turned to my father, who grabbed my hand and squeezed it.
We are going to have one last shot at cheese fries.
But I can't eat. He grinned.
Nope, but you can watch me eat, and you can have one of those bottled bloods. I called ahead and asked Marjorie to stock them for you. She misses you, you know.
I sighed. I really, really love you, Daddy.
Obviously,
he said, his eyes twinkling as we climbed out of the car. I'm sorry we haven't had much time together lately, I said as we entered the coffee shop. Marjorie, who'd been waiting tables at the coffee spot since it opened in 1956, whooped and pulled my face between her worn, bony hands.
Look at you, she cried, squeezing my cheeks in a death grip.
Her iron gray hair was coming loose from its top knot as she practically vibrated with excitement.
Oh, it's been so long since I've seen you, Janie, and you're getting married tomorrow. Oh, look at that ring. I'm so happy for you.
Thanks, Miss Marjorie.
I can't believe it's been almost 2 years since I've seen you, she said as Daddy and I slid into our usual booth with the cracked green leatherette seats.
Marjorie didn't bother handing us grease-spotted menus. Daddy's order never changed from cheese fries and a cherry Coke. I'm sorry. You tend to spend less time in restaurants when you don't eat solids.
That's all right, hon. Your daddy told me you like that faux typo. I'll grab one for you and heat it up, she said. John, I'll get your cheese fries going. I'll be right back.
Daddy chuckled at my shocked expression.
Marjorie's always been an energetic gal.
What was I saying?
You were apologizing for abandoning your father while pursuing silly things like running your own business and maintaining a relationship. Oh, and training my grandchild to be a good little vampire.
I'm sorry, Daddy.
Aw, hell, Jane. I'm glad you're so busy. I worried about you before when you were working at the library. You always seemed to be waiting for your life to start. I just want to make sure this is the life you wanted. I wouldn't want you to make a commitment to someone who didn't make you happy.
Dad, are you giving me the Mr. Bennet premarital speech from Pride and Prejudice?
Well, you are doing a sort of theme wedding.
Nice. Don't you think it's a little late in the game for this conversation? Are fathers of the bride supposed to get cold feet?
Any man standing on the verge of giving a daughter away has cold feet. When Jenny married Kent, I had to stop myself from throwing her in the back of the car and making a break for Hershey, Pennsylvania. It's nothing personal against Gabriel. He's a perfectly nice fella. I'm just saying, I know your mom has put a lot of pressure on you to settle down. I want to make sure you didn't say yes because you're afraid of being alone for the rest of eternity.
I'm not marrying him because I'm afraid of being alone. I'm marrying him because I don't want to live without him specifically. Because when I think about being without him, I feel sort of dizzy and sick, like I've been cut off from the tether that keeps me on the ground. That's about as flowery and romantic as I'm going to get. He smiled, his eyes watering a little.
No, that was just right. Believe it or not, that's exactly how I feel when I think about losing your mama.
That is hard to believe. I snorted as Marjorie slid piping hot fries dripping in gooey orange non-dairy cheese food in front of my father.
I don't know what I'm going to do now that you're all grown up.
Daddy, I'm 31 years old.
Yeah, but I could always come here and depend on you to listen to my stupid stories and humor your old man.
Well, you can still do that. You'll just have an extra pair of ears listening. Gabriel really likes you, you know.
I guess I like him. As much as I could like the man who's making me give away my baby girl,
he said quietly.
I couldn't hand you over to a man I didn't think deserved you, Janie.
Thank you, Daddy.
I paused, taking a sip of the warmed bottle of blood that Marjorie had dropped off at the table.
Why Hershey, Pennsylvania?
He shrugged. Jenny's wanted to go there since she was a little girl, ever since she heard that the street lamps are shaped like Hershey's kisses.
That's sweet.
What was my potential kidnapping destination? He reached across the table and squeezed my hand.
Right here.
I snorted. Exotic downtown Half Moon Hollow?
Well, you're a lot stronger than me. I knew I couldn't overpower you for long.
My wedding night set clear and warm, with a fingernail moon sliding low over the horizon. Jolene came bounding into my room at sunset, hopping up and down on the bed, bouncing me off onto the floor. I sat up and glared at her.
Andrea gave you espresso, didn't she?
Nope, she crowed, but she showed me how to work the machine.
Ugh,
I groaned, covering my face with a pillow.
Come on, Jane, it's your wedding night, she cried. Get up, get excited. Your mama's already been outside most of the day helping Iris get everything all set up. Oh, it's just gorgeous out there, like something out of one of your movies.
Really? I perked up, carefully retracting the sunproof shade so I could look out over the backyard. I gasped. When I'd gone to bed, it had looked like my backyard on any other night, just with lawn chairs lined up on it. Now, it looked positively elegant, with a long ivory aisle runner stretched between the rows of chairs to the arbor, which was covered in fluffy green moss and roses in shades of ivory, lavender, and yellow. Little wildflowers offset the overly formal look of the roses, making it seem as though some helpful soul had just walked through the gardens at River Oaks and picked a few blossoms. The chairs were looped with ivory bows. There were little glass globes with lit candles hanging from the trees and ivory paper lanterns. On the far side of the yard, I could see tables being set up for the reception. The rental service's employees were milling around the yard like an army of productive ants, setting up chairs, putting out table linens. Mama was in the middle of it all, conducting the chaos like a virtuoso.
"Where's Gabriel?"
I asked, stretching and checking the clock. We only had an hour before the wedding. With the sun setting so late during the summer, we couldn't wait too long after dusk, or we'd be entertaining our guests well past their bedtimes, and ours, for that matter.
"You'll be very proud of them,"
Jolene told me as I retrieved my fancy nuptial underwear set from the dresser and ran into the bathroom. She shouted through the bathroom door as I buckled myself into my strapless bra.
"The boys came home at a reasonable hour last night, mostly sober. Gabriel and Jamie crashed over at Dick and Andrea's to give you some space. Oh, and Jamie won $24 playing blackjack. He didn't try to feed on a single human, not once."
"That's good news." I emerged from the bathroom in my robe because, as close as we were, I wasn't going to hang out with Jolene and Andrea in my underwear for the next hour. The door burst open and my sister barreled into the room wearing her bridesmaid's dress.
"Who's ready to get married?"
I burst out cackling at the sight of my sister in her biohazard suit bridesmaid's dress. The neckline was off the shoulder, with a wide ruffle of egg yolk yellow that gathered at the cleavage with a fabric rose, which accented the bodice's descent into what can only be described as a waist lapel. The whole effect made even my classically beautiful sister look sallow and misshapen. I laughed so hard that I tried to sit on the bed to support my shaking legs, but I missed and ended up in a giggling heap on the floor.
"Oh, good. I see that trademark charm is going to be what sustains us all night."
"I'm sorry, Jenny. This is all my fault,"
Jolene assured her.
"I made Jane wear this dress at my wedding, and you're a victim of the fallout."
"She's a victim of fallout, all right,"
I giggled. Jenny glared at me. I sniffed and wiped at my eyes.
"Sorry."
"Really?" Jenny asked.
"No. But look, I painted my toenails to match your dresses."
I wiggled my toes in her direction to show her the neon yellow polish.
"Out of solidarity."
"Doesn't count," Jenny insisted. "Your shoes will cover them up. Now come on and get dressed. Kent and the boys can't wait to see what kind of outfit a vampire bride wears." I sniffed, wiping at my eyes as I rose. I managed to pull myself together, only to have Andrea come in wearing her dress, and I started giggling all over again. Jolene left to go get dressed, while Jenny and Andrea pulled me in front of the vanity. Remember, neutral tones, Jenny said, dumping a shoulder bag full of cosmetics onto the vanity. We want a light, smoky eye and a soft coral lip. And let's try to do something about those dark circles.
Hey, that's not fair. Vampires have dark circles. Andrea has dark circles.
Did you see them on my wedding night?
Andrea asked. No, I grumbled.
She preened. Because I know how to use concealer.
Mama came bustling into the room with a garment bag over her shoulder and a mug of blood in her hand. Because there just weren't enough people in the room already.
Hi, sweetie. Are you excited?
So excited I may vomit at any moment, I assured her.
Oh, you silly,
she chuckled, handing me the mug of warm donor A positive.
Gabriel said it would be better if you had something substantial in your system, so you're getting the real stuff today. Use the straw so you don't mess up your lipstick, and don't get that anywhere near the dresses. The last thing we need is you girls walking down the aisle looking like extras from the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
She hustled into the bathroom to change into her Mother of the Bride frock. I stared at her, my mouth hanging open. Did Mama just hand me a cup of human blood and then make a joke about a horror movie? I asked Jenny, who nodded, all astonishment.
Doesn't the Bible list that as one of the 7 signs of the apocalypse?
Well, not in the King James Version, Jenny said.
Ah,
I cried, dribbling blood back into the mug. Don't be clever while I'm drinking. Blood spit takes are gross. Andrea continued to lacquer my face while Jenny piled my hair on top of my head. A couple of pins, a little hairspray, and I had a perfectly acceptable bun to pin my veil to. Mama came out of the bathroom in a pretty dove gray suit and heels.
Well, that's just beautiful, girls. You did a great job. Now why don't you go downstairs and get that present for Jane? I'd like to help her get into her dress.
My friends were leaving me. Alone. With my mother. Right before a special occasion. I did not see this ending well for me. Maybe now was the moment to distract them all by revealing the real bridesmaids' dresses. Surely they'd suffered enough. But then, they all filed out of the room like dutiful little traitors, leaving me to the world's most awkward birds and the bees talk. No, they deserved the yellow dresses of shame. Mama got my wedding dress out of the closet and unzipped the garment bag.
Now, Janie, did you have questions for me about tonight?
No. I'm pretty clear on the ceremony stuff, Mama, I said, stepping out of my robe and into the dress she was very carefully holding open for me. I know I've been kind of a pain about this, but I really do appreciate all the effort you put into the planning.
Oh, I know, baby. But I meant questions about later tonight.
I paused for a moment. Then my jaw dropped. Mama continued,
It's just that after a few years, the two of you will get used to each other, and a married woman sometimes has to figure out special, efforts to keep her husband's interest piqued. Since the two of you will be together forever, you're going to have to work that much.